Mountain Goat frontman and novelist John Darnielle. From the Stud Turkle Awards, Susie Schultz and Kate Kahan. And live in Studio 435, the punk rock sounds of Absolutely Not. And now, here's your host, a man who is the punk rock of AM radio, Justin Kaufman.
I am. I'm like the Green Day of the WGN lineup. I'm the Blink 182 of 720 WGN. I'm the Rancid of, well, okay, never mind. Welcome to the download tonight here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight and very happy to be here riding shotgun with you on your ride home. Well, maybe you're listening at home right now, or maybe you're at work, wherever you are at. Maybe you're listening in Michigan Avenue as you walk past the studio. I thank you for listening, and I'm happy to be riding shotgun with you tonight. We have a tremendous show lined up for you. John Darnielle from the Mountain Goats is going to join us tonight. I'm very excited to talk with him. His book, Universal Harvester, is out. It's a new novel. Of course, John Darnielle, the frontman for the Mountain Goats, one of the most prolific songwriters of, I guess, folk indie rock, if you will, right? I mean, it's alt indie rock. He's amazing. The Mountain Goats are amazing. If you listen to them, you know what I'm talking about. John Darnielle will talk about his new novel. Coming up, Studs Terkel Award winner Kate Kahan joins me, my former colleague. She has, we have worked together for a long time, and it's great to see that she is getting the recognition she deserves as she has been inducted. I don't know if you just get the award if you're inducted to the she got a Studs Terkel Award, which is put on by the Public Narrative, and they have a big ceremony coming up here at the end of the week. So we'll talk with her and Susie Schultz about what makes a good story, what makes a good journalist. They're in studio tonight, my guests at the big table. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling are here. We'll just have to figure out what to talk about. There's so much to talk about. And like you said, Absolutely Not. Punk rock tonight on the download in Studio 435. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. This is 720 WGN Chicago. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's Download till 11 o'clock. Very excited to be here with you. Of course, tonight, got a great show, so let's get right to it. It's time for the carryout. This, of course, segment where I read the news, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Where do we even start? Do I do travel ban first? Or wait, maybe healthcare? Or how about wiretaps? Chance the Rapper, Ben Carson, referring to slaves as immigrants. It's Monday, everybody. Happy Monday. The Travel Ban 2 Electric Boogaloo is coming to a Homeland Security checkpoint near you. President Trump signed a new executive order to replace the last one, which was held up in court. What's the difference? Well, for one, Iraq has been omitted, so the ban only affects six countries. Also, this is about new visas, and people coming to this country for families or work can be reviewed by a case-by-case basis. But Dems and the ACLU say this is just a thinly veiled Muslim ban, and it's not going to pass muster in the courts. So what can we expect? Well, besides 5 a.m. Sunday morning tweets from the toilet, because that's really all I can expect these days, right? That's what we all can expect. No word on whether or not there will be lawsuits that will be filed, and this travel ban does address some of the issues that the courts had problems with, so we shall see. A new health care bill has been released by Republicans in Congress. Let me quickly go over, since it just dropped a half hour ago. I got it right here. Let's see. No subsidies. No. Just tax credits, stay on insurance till 26, pre-existing conditions, no death panels. Got it. All right. Some Republicans aren't happy because, well, that sounds pretty familiar. Also, they don't want the government paying for health care. That's what a tax credit or a subsidy is, regardless if used as an incentive to get people to use the open market plans. Senator Rand Paul said that it's Obamacare Light, which could be good. I mean, think about it. Nobody likes Michelob. Now, Michelob Light? Wait, nobody likes that either, so... Anyway, repeal! FBI Director James Comey came out and splashed some water on the old Obama is worse than Trump argument that started over the weekend. Comey said there was no wiretapping and allegedly went to the Department of Justice to get them to speak out against the Trump tweet. and said they didn't respond. They were all cowering behind the door, knocking on the door. I know you're in there. Don't answer. It's Comey. He's mad. Comey. Darned if you do, darned if you don't. Jeez, this guy can't get a break. It's been a record week for Chicago homicides in a good way. We didn't have any over an eight-day stretch. Yep. While there may have been no fatalities, there were 23 shootings this weekend. Modern medicine is keeping those victims alive, but that doesn't mean we should be doing our happy dance. I mean, they still got shot, right? Anyway, maybe change the headlines. Chance the Rapper still mad at the governor, telling him today in a news conference to do your job. Chance then announced he's donating $1 million to Chicago public schools and then asked local and national corporations to step up and bridge the gap. He should go one step. I think he should go one step further and just straight up pledge drive. For every $10 million that a company puts up, they get a guest spot on the next Chance record, right? Laugh it up, but you know that the head of Boeing is jamming no problems right now. No one more label tried to stop me. Yep. New study says that Chicago bridges are literally crumbling. 9 out of the 10 worst bridges mentioned in the new study were in the Chicago area. Since Chance the Rapper is giving $1 million to schools, I think Billy Corgan or Kanye need to step up for the bridges just so they could say, take it to the bridge. You can't say that in a song unless you actually pay up for the bridges, right? Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan put out a list of the biggest consumer complaints of the year. One was financial companies, but one of the largest increases have to do with for-profit schools where students are paying thousands for degrees they just can't use. It's awful. It's happened to me, too. I thought for sure tuna sandwich techniques was a great major. I don't know why I can't get a job. Subway won't even. Honda's beginning production on an automatic 10-speed transmission, which is bad news for those who like to make transmission noises with their mouth. You can't do it. It's too many. It was 5. You could do it. 10. That's too much. Snapchat came down to earth today, losing all the gains from their first day. They finished under their starting price. You may even say that their profits disappeared. No. In weather, 60 degrees for now. Never a good thing when March is this warm. This is the beginning of the severe weather season in the area. It's going to rain tonight. Crazy wind tomorrow. And it's going to get down to 27 and snow on Saturday. Are you not entertained? In sports, the Northwestern Wildcats lost their regular season final, but who cares? They're pretty much locked for the NCAA tournament. First up, though, the Big Ten tournament. That tournament starts on Wednesday in Washington, D.C., which seems like a very stupid place to play the Big Ten tournament. How many years have they played it here in Chicago at the UC where we had no rooting interest? Right? We're like, I guess we'll go see Purdue play Michigan State. Now Northwestern's in it. We got to go to Washington, D.C.? Come on. Fail. D. Wade is out tonight for the game against the Pistons. No big deal. Take a couple weeks off. Bulls are currently the 7th seed in the East at 31-31, which is better than last year, so everybody gets a raise. The NFL Combine was this weekend. Is it over? I think it's – I don't even know. Are they? I love turning the NFL Network channel on to watch people run. This week, starting on Thursday night, is the beginning of free agency. The Bears have $58 million available to make a splash. They've been linked to every single free agent out there, mostly corners and safeties, and that's a good thing. Buy them all. The Cubs won today. Arrieta made his debut, and Jason Hayward hit a homer. MVP. And finally tonight, peep-flavored Oreos are reportedly turning consumers' poop pink. Yep, a nasty byproduct for a delicious cookie? I'm not sure. Something tells me that pink poop is probably the best thing you're going to get from eating a Peep Oreo. Just a thought. That's the carry out for March 6, 2017. Happy Casimir Pulaski Day, everybody. In honor, we're giving away 2 Polish sausages for the price of, well, 2. I mean, we shouldn't just give it to you because it's a holiday. That's ridiculous. Nobody should do that. Coming up, Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy in studio. We got a lot to talk about tonight. Touche is going to be a hot one. It's going to be a hot mess. There's a lot going on. Stay tuned. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right. Touche.
You go right. It's time for Touche here on the download. 720 WGN. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling in studio. I don't even know where to begin. Do we start with the weekend and get our way to healthcare? Do we start with healthcare and just wait 5 minutes for a new story to break?
Like, I think the healthcare thing is just a simple. Because it has been said so many times. Republicans have no plan. I think we should just note the fact that an hour and a half ago or whatever, the Republican plan, the plan, right, after all of these different versions that they passed on the floor of the House when Obama was still president, but now the real plan of the Republicans in Congress has been published on a House Republican website. And I don't know that we have to say much more because it's going to be a long conversation.
It's already being analyzed as we speak.
Yeah.
The only thing I'll ask you, Chris, is that there already has been a division in the Republican Party.
Sure.
More conservative factions say no to any sort of tax credits, incentives, subsidies, anything. Where do you stand when it comes to this plan, which Senator Paul calls Obamacare Light?
Obamacare Light. I think that the Republicans are going to have to face the reality that Obama and the Democrats created a new entitlement. And I don't think that they can just sort of wipe that out. And, of the 20 million or so, there are 7 million who would be then cast adrift.
But didn't they run on wiping it out, Dave?
Only three times. and they've only repealed it 50 or 70. I lost track a lot of times. But the problem that the Republicans have, and this is the problem they've got, not just with the Obamacare stuff, but it's pretty much with everything, is that they said a lot of things for years and years and years because they couldn't actually affect the change because the Barack Obama was there to veto things. Now they are responsible for governing and they're having difficulty because on Obamacare, which is what we're talking about now, the math doesn't add up. If you want to protect pre-existing conditions, if you want to ensure that, you know, people under 26 and the, you know, and et cetera, you can't do the things that they did today and have the math work.
Right.
You're going to lose
$10 million. I wondered about that.
On a second. David is talking about a plan that has not yet been scored. So what he is saying is meaningless drivel. And it is important.
prescient prediction.
It's important for people to understand the meaningless drivel that David can spew.
Can we save this tape? I'm going to shove this back up your tushy, my friend, when that's scored and it turns out that you threw 10 million people off of their health insurance.
No, but that is what's not going to happen. People are not going to be thrown off of their health insurance. And I think that the problem that the Democrats, since David likes to say, here's the problem. The problem the Democrats have is they created this program 7 years ago. And everyone with an IQ over room temperature, which included at least some members of the, you know, Democrats in Congress, knew that it would collapse. And indeed, it is collapsing around our very eyes.
Actually, wouldn't have had you guys not sabotaged it by doing things like getting rid of the risk corridors, which were designed to deal with the problems that we're having now.
We're going to have plenty of touches to talk about healthcare. Let's move on.
Okay.
Travel Ban 2, Electric Boogaloo, came out today, getting rave reviews.
I know the guy who wrote that.
I got to repeat on the air what people were saying to me in Saudi Arabia. I think I said this off mic last week. I was in Saudi Arabia a week ago for about 8 days. And I would say, you know, kind of a little bit cautiously, how are we doing, or, you know, something like this. I was there on business, not as a representative of any government or anything like that. Do you hate all Americans? Because I happen to be one. And their answer was, we wouldn't let Libyans into this country in a million years. As a Sudanese, no way. We've got our Navy out there in the Red Sea preventing them from coming in. I mean, to be on the ground in the UAE or Qatar or Saudi Arabia is to have a sense of just how thoughtful this particular
ban is. Let me ask you this, Chris. Let's continue here. Does this travel ban, the second travel ban, does it address the issues that the court had a problem with? Does it essentially take away that this is a quote unquote Muslim ban?
Well, it wasn't a Muslim ban before because it was only applying to countries of less than 15% of the total Muslim population in the world. So it was not ever a Muslim ban. But I think that what you now have is an even more tailored application. And somebody's going to try and take it to court, but it's not this. This one will stick.
Dave, is this one appease people on the left or the ACLU? The idea that some of the things that were in this travel ban addressed some of the deficiencies of the first?
Not remotely. And Chris is wrong. It's not going to be upheld. But the other thing is that, you know, Chris, I love how we're comparing what people in one of the most restrictive anti-immigrant societies on earth, anti-woman, anti-immigrant societies on earth, feel about things like immigration. Of course the Saudis don't want to let people in. They didn't let Palestinians in. They didn't let Kuwaitis in. So I'm sorry, but those aren't my role models. I'm looking at Statue of Liberty going like, yeah, that's the one I'm looking for. So no, that's not how we're going to do things. Number two, you know, the problem with what's been happening up to this is that there have been all those leaked memos, like the intelligence agency at the Department of Homeland Security that wrote a memo that said, well, in fact, we really can't justify this ban based upon the way this ban is supposed to be justified, because you can't do it based upon national origin. It's really not a good predictor. And oh, by the way, if you did, then you got to have Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and some of these other countries that have actually given us terrorists in this country. So I think that what's going to happen with the travel ban is it's going to get thrown out just like the first one was.
Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling in studio. We've made it to the first break, and I'm excited because now we can talk about wiretaps, Russia. That's what we'll talk
wiretaps
about.
Wiretaps with two P's.
Two P's.
The wire.
The
wire.
Tap.
Two the P's. Wire.
We're playing. It's Touche here on The Download. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy in studio here on The Download, 720 WGN. All right. Wiretapping. This weekend, Saturday morning, President Trump goes to Twitter and he talks about a wiretap.
Have I said all along this guy's got impulse control problems?
You have.
I have
said that.
I've said that's one of his four issues, along with conflicts and, you know, detail.
Where
or
did
facts.
He get the so it's facts. Reported he got it from Breitbart
Mark Levin, who is on a sort of a web TV operation, and he's also on some radio stations, and he's a former chief of staff to Ed Meese when Ed Meese was the attorney general. Mark Levin put together a segment where he has about nine different publications that are each talking based on unnamed sources around intelligence gathering activities that kind of get closer and closer and closer to Trump Tower. And he presented these things with his usual vigor. And then a writer at Breitbart, I believe on Thursday, his Thursday program.
So a writer at Breitbart picks it up.
A writer at Breitbart then writes it up on Friday.
Right.
Then there is this huge blow up at the White House in the Oval Office, at which Trump is angry at Bannon and Priebus
for the recusal
because of the recusal by
Jeff Sessions.
This is 2 days. Yeah. It's crazy. And so he apparently in that blow up bars them from Air Force One. Says, I'm going to Mar-a-Lago. You guys have got to go commercial or something. I think they ended up going on Air Force One, but I mean, he was really ticked off.
And, all right. For the
and then
you
the
can't
next,
ride at my plane.
The next morning at 6 a.m. or 6 a.m.
He's tweeting this out.
He's tweeting this.
So
out.
So this is a big. I mean, obviously it's a huge claim because he's really playing off of a lot of the issues that are really sort of directed at the Trump campaign. This idea of hacking and getting Russia involved. This idea that for political advantage, the Obama administration was wiretapping an opposition campaign, which is straight out of Watergate. Is there any, I have to ask, I mean, the biggest question, you know, in the elephant in the room, is there any belief that this is true?
Well, so the most important news that was made yesterday was when the former director of national intelligence, James Clapper, was on Meet the Press. And he was asked by Chuck Todd, you know, basically, was there a FISA warrant? Did this happen? Because your theories are one of two things. One, totally illegal wiretapping. Two, it was legal wiretapping. Neither one of which are good stories.
I guess three is never happened.
Yeah, or three, it's fantasy.
He's basing it off of Levin's story.
Exactly. So when Clapper went on Meet the Press and he said Chuck Todd didn't think he'd actually confirm, and he's like, no, I could just deny it. It didn't happen. Not to the best of my knowledge that this happened. That was important because that took away the FISA option, because Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, would have known
about
it.
Does it take away the illegal wiretapping?
It doesn't take away the possibility of illegal wiretapping. But again, I mean, this is the conspiracy theorist. This is the Donald Trump with the birther stuff.
And well,
this is the
Hang on. This is the Donald Trump who has embraced
conspiracy theories repeatedly. This is the Donald Trump who accused Ted Cruz's dad of killing Kennedy.
He didn't say he killed Kennedy.
He said he helped Lee Harvey Oswald.
So
who killed Kennedy?
Let me just say the British journalist who wrote numerous of these Levin referenced articles is standing by her reporting. And she has basically said that in Trump Tower, there was a server that was of significance to United States intelligence. Now, the question then begins to arise about not what Clapper was actually very lawyerly and very precise. And Dave skipped over that. He said, not of Trump, the president-elect, not of Trump, the candidate, nor of his campaign. But most of what Levin was talking about was Trump associates.
Mm-hmm.
And so
But that's not what Trump was talking about.
I'm talking about the allegations here upon which apparently he has based this. But in any case, we don't know. And more importantly for the people driving home right now, is that we've got a president who was about 60 yards ahead of his White House, whether he was on firm ground or crumbling ground.
Regardless of the facts and anything.
Regardless of everything else.
Yeah, the White House didn't speak about this for like 12 hours.
They had no clue as to what to say. And this is part of the frustration.
Let me ask you, it's only 2 minutes left here, so let's get to a great point by 773. Does the Russia story, does it a backfire for the Democrats? Do you run into the risk?
I think so.
Do you run in the risk at pushing?
Yeah.
You uncover there was some illegal activity and the story changes.
By now, we would know if there was something there.
Nonsense.
There is nothing there.
Nonsense. You didn't know Watergate, what was really going on for Watergate for a year.
That's not
true. These Republicans who are trying to say that, well, there's no concrete evidence yet, so drop it. It's like,
I'm sorry, David. The Republicans on Saturday in the House and in the Senate said, we're adding this to our investigation.
Right, exactly.
That's not dropping it.
To which we're adding it to our investigation of what? Look, the fact is, this is fantasy land. There was no Barack Obama, or as Donald Trump referred to him, sick guy, did not order a wiretap, because he's not allowed to. That's not what presidents do anymore, of Donald Trump's phones, which is exactly what the accusation was. Words matter, specifics matter. And here's the bigger problem for the Republicans, like my friend Chris here. And I predicted this for a year. You guys are stuck having to defend the indefensible. And so what's happening is that you just had Homeland Security Secretary, former General John Kelly, who came out on Wolf Blitzer's show and said, well, the president said this, so he had reason to say it. I mean, this is Donna Shalala defending Bill Clinton against sex.
What do you think of that, Chris? Last word.
I think there is an epic struggle going on well beneath the headlines, well beneath the articles. And we are seeing only little blips of it out there on the horizon.
It's a great story. I can't wait to have I can't wait till the next touche. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy.
Oh, my God. Then there will be like 147 different crazy things coming out.
I love that Chris has already gotten up. He said his word. He's out. He's off the mic.
That was a mic drop.
Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, every Monday night here on Touche on the Download. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Tonight, John Darnielle's going to join us. He's the frontman for the Mountain Goats. He's got a new novel out, his second novel, Universal Harvester is the name of the novel. He's getting great reviews for it. It's set in rural Iowa. We're going to talk with John Darnielle coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Also coming up tonight in Studio 435, our presentation of live music here on Michigan Avenue, the punk rock band Absolutely Not, which is the greatest name for a punk rock band, right? If they, I don't think that they'd come up with a better name for a punk rock band. So that's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. Well, tonight at the big table, we thought we'd take some time to talk about what makes a great news story and also what makes a great storyteller. The journalist. We've been caught in the middle of an all-out war between journalists and the White House with phrases like enemy of the people thrown around in less than 140 characters. With all the talk, you wonder why anyone would want to get into this profession. Well, tonight we shed a positive light on some working in this maligned industry. The Studs Terkel Awards are given out each year to outstanding journalists and storytellers who give voice to the voiceless. This year, the awardees include Stephen Mills from the Chicago Tribune, photographer Carlos Javier Ortiz, the entire Chicago newsroom of Univision, and my next guest, Kate Cahan. Cahan has been an editor at Chicago Public Media for 16 years, namely working the education beat, as well as criminal justice, politics, among many others. She's currently the special projects editor. During her career, Kate has won numerous awards, both here in Chicago and nationally. In full disclosure, Kate and I worked together for about almost all that 16 years at Chicago Public Media. Also joining Kate tonight is Susie Schultz. She's the president of the Public Narrative, the organization that presents the Studs Terkel Awards. The awards presentation will be at the National Hellenic Museum in Greektown this Thursday night, and I welcome you both to the big table. Good to
hey,
see you.
Justin.
Good to see you, Kate.
Justin,
how are you?
We're good.
All right. So let's first.
I'm
let's
a little
talk.
Intimidated. Susie has lots of notes. She's, I don't have any notes.
Yeah. She comes prepared.
Well, you know. It's just a different style because tickets are available, so I'm here for a different reason.
For a different reason. All right. So let's talk about the Studs Terkel Awards. This is something you guys have been doing for years. Talk about the why you do it and why you do it in Studs' name.
Well, you know, I inherited Public Narrative, and when I did, it was called Community Media Workshop.
Of course, yeah.
And two amazing men, Tom Clark and Hank DeZetter, founded this organization almost 30 years ago now. And they knew Studs. Studs was a good buddy, especially of Hank DeZetter. They'd been together for a while. And as they moved along, you know, not only were they was the charge to teach nonprofits how to tell their story, because, you know, there's so much going on in the neighborhoods, and somehow or another there was this disconnect of the downtown media not understanding what people were doing out there. So they got this idea, they went to the MacArthur Foundation, they got money, and they said, we're going to teach people. And at that point, they were teaching people how to fax to people,
right,
you know,
right,
so
right.
So that they could get into the news. And as we've evolved, we outgrew that name, Community Media Workshop, because not only were we working with people in nonprofits how to tell stories, but we were working with the media as well. We were trying to help them because the more time has gone by, and as we know where we are now, the more complex it is to do reporting, and particularly to do issue reporting,
when
which
you
is
do,
what
and,
we specialize
and also
in.
Reporting that is, like you said, not downtown, not the big stories of the day, the things that you will read in the newspaper or maybe hear in the headlines in the 10 o'clock news. These are different types of stories. Your organization helps journalists, helps people in the community be able to tell that story and to be able to do it in a way that you can in this cash-strapped, resourceless time that we are currently working in.
And, you know, I think there was a fear from both Hank and Tom that if you start saying you're not doing this to journalists, that it becomes this negative reinforcement. So what they wanted to do was, instead of just saying you're not doing this, say, yes, some of you are really doing this, and elevate those journalists who are really doing a great job of it. And so they got together with Studs, and they asked him permission, can we use your name for this award? And Studs, who's Studs, was all in it. It wasn't just like, well, you're not only going to use my name, but I'm going to help you figure out who's going to get these awards, because I'm going to love learning about not just the old guard, but the new guard of journalists. I'm going to come to this award program, and darned if the man, up until the year before he died, didn't stand there, hand out the awards, choose the people, and sing. And we still do this at the end of every awards presentation. We all sing This Land Is Your Land, because it was his favorite song.
Kate Cahan is one of the winners this year of the Studs Terkel Awards. It is interesting because you had a chance to work with Studs Terkel a little bit.
Do you remember that?
I remember that, yeah.
I remember
early
you
days.
When...
I have a great picture I just found right. of me with hair and a really, really goofy green tie
and
Studs Terkel,
right
yeah. But yeah. Talk about working with Studs Terkel. What do you remember of Studs Terkel?
First of all, I'll say to Susie and to you, this is the award that journalists in Chicago want. Because feel the best about, maybe you don't even think about wanting it, but because it's about people, it's about listening, it's about what is at the heart of what we do when we do it the best.
Right.
And so I think I came in the end of the 90s, right before 2000, and worked with Justin. And the whole place at WBEZ was sort of infused with this Turkillian, you know, with Studs's mood and this feeling like we're going to get Mavis Staples and we're going to get, all these people in who just wrote books, and we're going to get artists, and we're going to get opera singers. And he would just gush in a way, but in a curiosity, and pull people out. And the whole place kind of had that vibe, right?
Well, I mean,
we loved that kind
of journalism. It's fun to listen, Susie, to the public narrative's mission and this idea of voice of the voiceless and getting out past the headlines, because I know for a fact you picked the right person to give an award to, because that has been Kate's mission in newsrooms, not just at WBEZ, but at WBBM and other places. That, I mean, that really has, really is sort of your mantra, if not your sort of mission, your mission statement as a journalist.
What is? Voice of the voiceless. I would say yes. I think you're right, Justin. we used to argue all the time.
I was like, we need more voice of the powerful. That was my argument.
She'd be
like,
voice of the voiceless. Come on, right? Justin, a little too much power. No, I think that's true. And I think it's public radio, for one thing, of course, has that. But I think that's the combination of these organizations, right? Mm-hmm. Odette Youssef, one of our reporters, was, I think, just last week training with public narrative and trying to get people more accessible, making us more accessible to community people who might have a story to tell, who might have, and she was part of training and sort of a speed dating you did.
So what we try to do is, so we train people who are in community organizations how to tell a better story and how to step back to be able to say exactly what's going on. You get so inundated when you're in a nonprofit, because we are a nonprofit as well, with what happened yesterday. Let me tell you what happened yesterday.
Yeah.
Instead of what's our bigger idea, what's our bigger mission, who do we touch, how can we tell you about our numbers, how can we tell you about our human face. So we train them, and then we train journalists. And our secret sauce, Mo, when we were renamed, we found, we tried to do this big search to figure out, does anybody do what we do? Firebelly Inc. helped us figure out our new website and our new, and they, the owner, Don Hancock, said, I had my people looking because I was sure there was going to be somebody else who does this. And the reality is nobody brings those groups together.
Yeah.
And why is because it's so hard. A lot of this has to do with what we specialize in is relationship building.
It's fascinating because you really are training the communities to be able to talk to journalists, and in the same way you have to train journalists to be able to understand what the communities are saying, because, you know, there are a lot of time commitments and restraints, and we talked about resources where some journalists are going to be like, I'm going to go to whoever's in front of me and we're going to talk about the story. I mean, that is something that you see every single day in all sorts of mediums here.
Well,
in
the class that Odette was kind enough to come to speak to, we had four or five journalists there. It was about 20 people. And we did a special outreach to people who are working in organizations that serve predominantly Muslim populations. Because in December, it was very clear that what was happening for them was very scary. And we knew from people that we have relationships with that there was an awful lot of violence, harassment, and fear in those communities. But they did not want to talk to the media, because they were afraid of the media. They were afraid by talking to the media, they would increase that.
Well, let's take a quick break, because I want to come back and talk about that very notion, this idea of the media with a capital M, this, you know, what we've seen in Washington and what we've seen locally where communities don't want to talk to the media because there's part of a fear of not getting the story right. And that's something that we see time and time again, not from the people in studio tonight. Susie Schultz is the president of the Public Narrative. They are the ones who put on the Studs Terkel Awards, which will be presented at the National Hellenic Museum in Greektown this Thursday night. One of the people getting the awards, Kate Cahan, special projects editor at Chicago Public Media. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. More conversation here at the Big Table. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. My guest at the big table tonight, Kate Cahan, Special Projects Editor at Chicago Public Media and a winner of this year's Studs Terkel Award, along with Stephen Mills, photographer Carlos Javier Ortiz, and the entire Chicago newsroom of Univision. Susie Schultz, also the president of Public Narrative, the organization that gives out the Studs Terkel Awards. I love having you both here because we could talk about some of the issues that are happening in the news. We kind of talked about media. Let's pick up on the idea that communities don't want to talk to the media. And this is something that, you know, journalists don't really go deeper to try and figure that out. I mean,
well, some do. And that's the ones that, you know, we love to highlight. But what I see right now, especially, you know, here we are today, that third immigration order has been revised. But we put a program on last week to teach journalists about the other two immigration orders, because what we were seeing was, you know, Chicago is a community of immigrants. We speak more than 100 languages in the Chicago public schools. And when this first came down, when this first hit, yes, the media were concentrating a lot, and rightly so. I'm not criticizing this at all, but we're concentrating on that first executive order that was a Muslim ban because so much was going on at the airports. Well, the communities started concentrating on the other two executive orders that have very scary and vague language.
This is deportation.
The deportation. Yeah, it talks about things such as incentivizing law enforcement and criminalizing any criminal behavior, which really could be anything. So we went out and we talked to an awful lot of immigration groups who were training other people, sat through some of those trainings to really see what was going on. And two things we found out. One, what was amazing was the way the communities were mobilizing. They were moving quickly and still are moving quickly. And two, this was not just one community that you would talk to. It was not just Latinos. I went to a training where it was Latinos, it was Koreans, it was Africans. It was all these people who believe their rights may be taken away from them. And the training went as deep as saying, should you reapply for DACA? And then as light as saying, whatever you do, don't hang anything from your rearview mirror, because that's a cause to stop you.
Kate, as an editor, you've had such a tremendous roster of reporters who have reported to you, that you've worked on stories, award-winning stories that many of our listeners here have heard. I'm intrigued on that concept of getting reporters to go deeper to understand the communities that they cover, because when we talk about voice of the voiceless or voice of the voiceless, a lot of times it is sort of avoiding the stereotype or avoiding sort of the first line of people that, oh, this person is the person who speaks for the gay community or for the Latino community. You have to go deeper.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things I think all of journalism is tasking itself, and so are we, is to create a more diverse staff, to have people who are of communities that we want to be part of this whole conversation. I think we're getting much better at that, much more aware of that anyway. Mm-hmm. And I think I find something a little different than what Susie finds, because I think our reporters work very, very hard at those relationships. Like, that's a part of it. It's part of a beat in that our beats are not just criminal justice or education. There are issues. There's race and inequity, and to find those stories, they have to develop relationships and just hang out, and they do. And that's, I feel like we're able to do your other point earlier about from your intro where you were saying what makes a good story. You have to have a good reporter with sort of Studs Terkel characteristics, but with heart and with curiosity and with empathy. And
absolutely,
then, and then you build this intimate story that has big shoulders, that says something bigger, that says something important about all of the city. And that's, I think, to what you guys talk about at Public Narrative, what connects people. Like, I hear a story in Roseland that's about something that in Rogers Park or even in Lake Forest rings true to me because it's told from an intimate, maybe family point of view, or it's somebody struggling with just getting to this country or trying to find a job or trying to fight City Hall. Right. And all of a sudden, that makes sense to me.
Well, it's interesting. Studs Terkel, you think of Division Street America and the concept of going and talking to people along one street. And this concept of the way that it's done, respecting the stories and letting the stories speak for themselves. If you've ever read that book, that's what that is. And there's something that you learn of that it's not necessarily what you think. And the person has the storyteller, in this case Studs Terkel, has the ability to pull out the real story of the people who are living on Division Street. That's similar in the concepts that we need more of that in journalism now, so people could tell their own stories and they can be respected. They're not necessarily quickly like, that's wrong. Every time I hear someone say, this is my story, no.
Right. So I get into the whole thing. We've taught a lot of journalists nationally and locally about criminal justice. And when Kate is talking about the WBEZ newsroom, it's one that, you know, I would hold up as the way it should be done. Those relationships, the beat reporting, we need to have new technology in what we do. But that doesn't mean that we give way to all the old ways, because a good reporter builds those relationships. And about a year and a half ago, we gave a national workshop for journalists on how to better cover race, police, and community. And we had reporters from Chicago, but also from all over the country. And what I found really interesting was that one of the police commanders from Englewood stood in front of these people and said, I don't know any of you. You come, you parachute into my community. This is a community that I've lived in. This is a community that I care about. Why would I talk to you? So, you know, building those relationships as a reporter is important. And this is part of what we have lost in reporting. It doesn't mean that we can't find it again. In fact, many people are, as examples. We need to have time for the reporters to build those relationships. And they are now tasked with producing not just the stories, whatever the platform, but they're on social media and they're taking their own pictures and they're doing this. And they have to have that time to be able to sit down with somebody, look them in the eye so that they can trust them. They can build that trust.
Susie Schultz is the president of the Public Narrative. Also in studio, Kate Cahan, who is one of the winners of the Studs Terkel Awards this year. The awards presentation is going to be held at the National Hellenic Museum in Greektown on Thursday night. We'll take a break. Let's get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back. Let's talk about what stands in the way of good stories. And then also this concept of is the present day a good time or a bad time for journalists? We'll have that conversation. Susie and Kate in studio at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio, reminiscing about the old days with Kate Cahan, special projects editor at Chicago Public Media. We worked together for years. She is the recipient of a Studs Terkel Award this year, and I love it. Susie Schultz, also in studio, the president of the Public Narrative, who give out the award. They're having their big presentation on Thursday night, which do you have to give a speech? Kate?
I think I have a few minutes. Susie said I could have a few minutes, so I'm.
Do you
I'm
yank
practice.
Them if they go too long, Susie?
They should.
Well,
it's
before
Thursday.
We embarrass ourselves.
You know, I'm just going to step in because we have four journalists that we're awarding, but we also do something for the people who support us. And so Terry Massaney is also going to be honored Thursday night, who's head of the Chicago Community Trust, because, you know, none of us, journalists or whatever, can do what we do if we don't have people supporting us.
You should honor him for his 1 week where he was the Chicago schools chief. Remember
that? Was more than that.
So like
he was a long
month?
Time that, but he did, he did
right.
a good job. All right,
let's talk journalism.
Off air, is that,
yeah,
you know, in between the times we were on, we were talking about the future of journalism.
Is so it that's a good time or a bad time to be a journalist?
It is the best time, Justin.
Really?
It's not a bad time. And your intro made it sound, and you're scaring the young people away. Don't do that.
No, I don't agree.
This is chaos. Chaos is the best time. Remember, after we were just talking about 9/11, we worked together after 9/11. People want and need what factual, fact-based media has. I think there's room for lots of variations on, you know, personal blogs and all that. All that is can be good, but people want this in a way that doesn't go away.
There's an amazing amount of consternation. I don't even know what the word would be around this idea of objective media. This concept of whether or not anyone can be objective. We see what happens in, the Trump administration calls out mainstream media like the New York Times as liberal hit pieces. On the right, you have Breitbart and other places. I mean, how do you navigate as an editor? As someone who works for public radio, which Trump would probably say goes on to the left side, how do you make sure that you're objective? How do you make sure you're telling stories in a way that are all about facts, that are getting the story across without any bias?
Right, and we've had a lot of conversations about it. If you remember, we've sat around and talked about it. But I think the first thing, I think objective is maybe not a good word. We have to put that aside. Open is a word that I like. That if we, and to get back to diversity, if we have a diversity of people inside, if we go out to a diverse amount of people, if we are actively seeking different points of view, it'll be okay because we'll capture that. But we have to, and that's not objective. That's not fake balance.
Right.
It's trying to cast your net openly and your curiosity openly. And to me, that is going to be our salvation.
You have to be inclusive if you want to be relevant. You have to include these voices. You have to go find these voices. I mean, we looked at what the report was coming down, a whole analysis of the New York Times and how it's kind of turned away from having women since they lost their editor at the top, who was a woman. It's now there's not that many women voices. If you don't have those voices at the table when you're making the choices about what you will cover, then you don't have the ability to know where the stories are. You don't know what you don't know.
Let me ask you a question about the audience, because more and more we're seeing audiences choose to be siloed. Meaning they don't, you're not getting people who are going to both sides. I'm going to go home and I'm going to be open to both sides. They get their source from one place. They feel like it's like-minded. They go, how do you find yourself behind the eight ball doing open objective journalism in the way that people want the other stuff? They want, and it affects your bottom line.
I think some people might want the other stuff, but that doesn't mean we have to give it to them. I feel like one of the dangers when you're feeling beleaguered as a profession is to try to guess what everybody wants and give it to them.
And we've done that a lot in journalism for the last 10 years. Yeah.
And be everything to everybody and keep a low sort of affect so you're not offending anyone. I think being bold is going to be our salvation. And the only way that we can really keep people believing. The other thing is to be transparent. And I think that is our, like, where'd you get the story? How'd you get the story? Who'd you talk to? What's your data? Where'd it come from? And as other people don't do that.
I'll push back on that.
There was so many, after about a month or so ago, I wrote 6 things that journalists need to do to make sure that they are respected as we move ahead. Transparency is one of the most important things that you can do. My covenant with you as an audience is I can only tell you what I know and where that came from. And when you start obfuscating your sources and you stop saying, well, then it makes it seem like it's this insider ball game, and you alienate me as an audience, because I'm like, I can't judge whether that is important information, accurate information, but if I know where it came from, I can go,
what do you say? I mean, what do you say to the idea that, you know, the enemy of transparency are the people in power? There, even as we hear, you know, elected officials talk about this new era of transparency and data portals and other things, we know they will do everything they possibly can to not tell you the real story or to give you the information that you need as a journalist. So how do you stay transparent when the only people that are giving you stories, as we see with the White House, are sources, are anonymous, are leaks? How do you do that and be able to talk to your audience and be straight, like you just said, and say, this is where I got the story from?
You go around them. That's what you do. You get people who I mean, one person in power has a very limited megaphone. They can shut down, but after a while, we know exactly what, you know, it's like I always say to reporters, we're not there to put our hands out and have them pour the story in. We're out there to go around, and we can corroborate maybe what yeah. we're being told, but we have to get those facts ourselves, and that's fact-checking, all the things that we've come to expect from, and you know, from the big newspapers, the big outlets.
You know, it's the good old-fashioned beat reporting. If I sit and I have 25 people that I call once a month on my beat to find out what's going on, they're not the people of title necessarily, uh-huh. but they might be the people that are pushing the papers, and they might be the people that are working in all sorts of different offices. If I put all these inclusive voices in there and I call that group of 25 once a month, I'm going to find this stuff out. I mean, you look at somebody like at the New York Times, Robert Pair. Robert Pair has been there for decades. Uh-huh. Robert Pair knows healthcare better than anybody in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. During the 90s and the 2000s, it was pretty much a decree was sent out to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Nobody was allowed to talk to Robert Pair. Well, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is second only to defense in its budget and its number of employees. So you might have a handful of the public officials up there in Washington, D.C., who aren't talking to you, but you have all of these people out in the field who know what's going on. And the majority, this is where we, you know, we demonize not only journalists, but we demonize government. The majority of people who get into government, they do right. want to help. They do
well,
want to do something.
I'm interested, Kate, because I sat next to you in cubicles, and I've right. seen you had adversarial relationships with governmental affairs.
Oh, I never did.
but my point being that there is a job. It seems like there's a person in government, in any department, whose job it is to sort of keep media at arm's length. To
well, that is their job.
That's their job.
Their job is to make sure their department, their boss, looks good.
So how do you get around that when they're not get you? You have a story and you bring that story, and Rob or Linda or someone has a story, and they say right. you bring it to right. them and say this is the thing, and they go nah.
How do you do that? It's partly getting trusting relationships with people inside, so they let you go where you want to go. That's not always easy. An example of something that we did, what the station did. Recently, but it was really Linda Lutton who did it, was, you know, she had a
education
big
reporter, right.
Education, Linda Lutton's an education reporter, a premier education reporter at our station.
In the country.
And in the country. And, you know, her objective was to do a story on poverty and education, and can schools really solve it? Can they take a kid from a poor background and put them on the same track as anybody else? From middle class or upper class? And the answer from the statistics is no. And we keep saying schools, American way, schools can do it. And so did she go to CPS and ask for information? Did she read, she was a scholar, she learned, she had a fellowship, but she went into school and she spent time in a community, in a fourth grade classroom for a year and saw for herself. And that's where you get what Susie's talking about, the irrefutable facts.
Now, I mean, we've had these conversations on the show about the idea that, we've seen more and more someone from an organization or from a governmental area like a CPS or the mayor's office send someone with. You know, like someone goes and stands next to Linda or stands next
Nobody
to
Nobody would want to stay as long as Linda. I mean, you wear them out, really.
That's what she's good at.
Her documentary is an hour, and I recommend it. It's called
That's great.
It's wonderful.
The View from Room 205.
Just got retweeted by Chance the Rapper, right?
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. But Natalie just did this big, long thing about a half an hour on her family's black home ownership quest. And people take time. And I think that, so it's access, you're right, but it's also wearing them out. And that's what we do best. We just wear them out and we keep on.
Susie,
Mitchell
let me ask you
just
both,
keeps on going after
so, but
people.
But you know, too, there's a roadmap for this stuff. I mean, if we look at the SPJ Code of Ethics, which really tells us how to do some of this stuff and what our rules are, what we don't do, how we don't harm people who aren't in power, how we move ahead and we try to find the truth and where we find the truth. I totally agree with you. I totally disagree with using the word objective. Nobody can be objective, and you need to know that because you need to examine as a reporter, what are my biases? And mm-hmm. so then I need to go over and make sure that I'm accommodating those biases and I'm working more for them. But I can be fair. I can really be fair if I work hard to make sure that I get both sides of the story and some context into it.
What do you do, and I ask you about this, but what do you do when you get something wrong? You know, we've seen this with this Trump America where articles are wrong, where the Washington Post or the New York Times will even say they're wrong. What do you do as an editor or journalist or reporter when you get something wrong?
Well, we do what is a series of steps. Maybe we get a call, we get a complaint. I stand by the story and the reporter as we check it out. And then, you know, we always listen and we always check out every complaint. And then we would do an on-air correction. We do an online correction if we were wrong. And I think that's just part of the code we live by, that we made a mistake and we take care of it, and we take care of it in just straightforwardly.
Susie?
So when Obama was elected, I was working at a little paper in southwest of here in Kankakee for the small newspaper group run by the small family. And these were the people who elected Trump. And we had, when I walked in there, not only was I the outsider, I was from the city. We were known as the Daily... It was the Daily Journal, but we were known as the Daily Urinal. So we had a big... It was just, I was like, ha, ha, ha. So we had a big turnaround on my hands. How do we get the community to see that not only are we all in this together, but we're fighting a fight for you to get information and power? Because we were considered, again, the paper that comes in and asks these rude questions and does all of these different things. And so we had to educate the public about who we are and what journalism is. And I would go out and talk to people. My reporters were available to go out. One of the things I don't think we do very well as journalists is tell the story of journalism. Why is it that we do this story? I had people calling me up saying, "You're such a rude woman. All those FOIs, which are Freedom of Information Act, that you have people file, why don't they just ask for the information? They're my neighbors. I'll give them to them." And I say, well, this is the law. So we're following the law, and this is what we do. So when I got enough calls, we ended up having a huge forum of about 500 people to just talk about what freedom of information is. We handed out resources. We give people information to say, this is why we're asking this. And this is why you have a right to know the superintendent's salary, but you don't necessarily have the right to know my salary because I'm not a public employee. People don't necessarily understand what journalists do. So telling that story allows us to be a little bit more transparent. And I push for people, when you call politicians, putting the quote in there is really important. But what I think is also important is who's not calling you back. Of my public officials, who did not call you back? So I know who doesn't respect my right as your audience to know.
Man, for all the people who haven't called me back in the years of doing this, I'm like, that made me think.
Taking out a full page.
Oh, man, that's true. Susie Schultz is the president of the Public Narrative. They give out the Studs Terkel Awards. The presentation will be at the National Hellenic Museum in Greektown this Thursday night. It's from 5 to 8? What is that?
It's from 5 to 8. Tickets are still available. It would be great if you really believe in great journalism and celebrating wonderful journalists. Come and join us. And come. This is great because a lot of journalists come. You can meet them. You can talk to them. And it's nice to be able to go up to people who are doing a phenomenal job and say thank you.
The awardees include Terry Mazzani for philanthropy, but also Stephen Mills from the Chicago Tribune, photographer Carlos Javier Ortiz, the entire Chicago newsroom of Univision, and my guest tonight, Kate Cahan. Kate, the process in which this award is given, it looks to people of the past who have won the award, and they say, who else deserves it? And overwhelmingly, I don't know what the number was, but it's a lot of people said, you know who deserves it? Kate Cahan. What does that mean to you?
Oh, goodness. It means, I think when Susie called me, I was pretty amazed. It means a lot. As I said earlier, it's the award that makes you feel like you did what you were supposed to do here in this place and time. This is local journalism. It's our place to tell stories. And that's what Studs did here and what I think the people who win this award try to do, at least the others that I've looked, you know, and known all of them, a lot from BEZ, but other places as well, and a lot of other places. So it's a really big honor.
Kate Cahan, Susie Schultz, it's a tremendous honor to have you guys here at the big table tonight. Kate, congratulations.
Thank you, Justin.
I would have voted if
yes,
I could.
Kate. Are you going to come back? Are you going to come back to us?
I will. I am going to. No, but I will come to the, I want to come to the ceremony on Friday or Thursday.
Thursday.
Yeah. Thursday at the Hellenic Museum, 5 to 8. For Kate and the other...
Go to publicnarrative.org.
Publicnarrative.org. Susie Schultz, Kate Cahan, thanks for being here.
Thanks.
219 says a good reporter will keep his or her bosses out of the story they're reporting. Depends on which bosses. Your boss is Kate, who's the editor. You want them in this story because they help you. We didn't even talk about what a good editor does. So much stuff we could have talked about. Because one of the things that's great is not only the amount of fact-checking that goes into that job at the editorial level, at the, being an editor, but also, you know, just the shaping of the story, the sort of conversations and the back and forth of the script and the meetings. I've had the great experience, and I've won awards in my life at Kate Cahan as my editor. She was it's fun to think about. There was a story I did on the, I forgot the, it was the Hebron, Illinois basketball, like high school basketball team, at one point or another won the state championship, and it was an anniversary piece from like 60, 70, 50 years or something like that. And I remember like working it out with Kate, and she'd help me. And I mean, it was like, it was amazing how many people would have that same experience to do that. But it was awesome to talk to Kate Cahan tonight. I haven't seen her in a while. She actually was a funny story. She was at my wedding back in 2004. And on the way from the church to the reception, she got rear-ended. We didn't talk about that. We should have 10 minutes on that, right? I remember being like, hey, it's not my problem. There's nothing I can do about it right now. I got a tuxedo on. I got to go out and do this cut the cake thing. There's nothing I can do about it. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Happy Casimir Pulaski Day. Love this holiday. This is one of those that was so great, and they ruined it in the way that it used to be a day off of school. Chicago Public Schools used to get the day off. I think all schools did. Somewhere along the line, that just wasn't good enough for all the adults. They took it away. Now it's we commemorate the day and honor the spirit of Casimir Pulaski, an American revolutionary hero, by just doing talk show segments. I learned more about Casimir Pulaski and who he was by getting the day off. When I got the day off, I was like, oh, I should probably know who this is. Now, what I mean, if I ask my son right now, I'd be like, who's Casimir? Do you get to even talk about it in school today? I'd be like, no, we talked about Pokemon. No, I don't know. We talked about fractions. We did the Fight for Air Climb on Sunday. I killed it. Not as fast as Pete. Pete's competitive.
Mm-hmm.
You're a competitive stair climber.
Mm-hmm.
I can't wait for the X Game competitive stair climb. You know, the gold medal game. Sort of, you see like when you're watching the outdoor games where two lumberjacks are cutting down
a
tree.
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, they did it! They got the gold medal! That's going to be you. What was your time? Do you know what your time was? So to give you an idea, my time was 10 minutes. each tower. You do four towers. Well, back up, if you're first listening to WGN, because I feel like we talked about this ad nauseum in the last two, 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
American Lung Association does a fight for air climb. It's to help people, or to sort of raise awareness for lung cancer.
Mm-hmm.
You sign up, you climb the presidential towers right by downtown, like mm-hmm. where the Kennedy Expressway is at, the four towers there,
mm-hmm.
about 50 plus stairs
mm-hmm.
or floors.
Mm-hmm.
And you do it for charity. And we had a WGN TV, a team that was probably 20 plus
deep. Yeah, tons
of people.
A lot of people
came out.
Great.
And we've caught you up. It takes, for me, about average 10 minutes per tower. It's a lot of heaving, a lot of stopping, going, you go ahead. I need to change my song. That's a regular. What about you?
I did mine in like around 7 minutes.
Oh, look at you, huh?
I was happy that my first tower I did in 7:06. And then, like, the next two around 7:15. And then my last tower I did in 7:03.
What? How did you do that? What are you, are you a machine? Are you a robot? How do you get faster on the last tower? Did you do that on purpose?
No.
Did you say, okay, I'm going to.
No.
I mean, I was having, like, chasers, in my eyes. They were like the precursor to passing out by like the 20th floor of Tower 3. I don't know how you were possibly had the energy to do that. Did you eat like an extra banana?
No.
What was it? I mean, just in shape. You're in shape.
Yeah. I guess so. I can climb stairs. And it's not that fast. I think when we got the results in the mail today and I was looking to see.
The results in the mail?
Yeah.
Oh.
I was like 120 something out of 1,000.
Wow.
But well, like, there's other, like, Mark Carmen from here was high. Jackie from the station, really high.
Did you see where I was in the, it's close to the. The other thing that I do, I mean, you're supposed to raise money for this. It's like the old fundraiser where you hit up your friends. And I just, because, you know, I have dedicated my life to this show and to putting on good material. I don't have time to sign up for events. So Sunday morning at 8:00, I just showed up.
Yeah.
And yeah. I'm like, where do I climb? And they're like, you got to sign up. What? What do you mean I got to sign up? You have to pay. So I had to pay out of pocket, which is okay because then I feel better.
Yeah.
You know, when I go to tax time, I'm like, well, I did give to charity. I did get $100, which really, if you think about it, is 200 with all the energy that was expended, not to mention the time lost. I could be doing other things. So I go to my account and I'm like, it was probably closer to 1,000 than 100.
The good thing is that by not signing up, like when you sign up, you get a lot of emails.
Oh, really? I missed all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm off grid.
Yeah.
They don't even know I exist.
So I think you might have this locked in.
Yeah. The only downside is there was no T-shirt for me. So there's team T-shirts. Maureen made great T-shirts. Thanks to Maureen and Stephanie and everyone who put together and helped out on this. It was unbelievable. But they were very efficient with the T-shirts. Like, they're like, if you signed up, you get a T-shirt. That's mm-hmm. how they ordered. I mean, I might order a couple more larges just in case, right? But that wasn't how it worked out. So all they had left, someone didn't show up, was like a medium, and I put it on, and I was like, you know, like the shirt held on one of my arms. I was like, I think I'll stay with my. But the problem was is that I had a similar colored shirt, so it worked out fine.
Yeah.
But the problem with that show, it was kind of like almost like a terry cloth-ish old navy V-neck,
mm-hmm.
which is awesome on a breezy summer day. Not so awesome when you're on the 38th floor of Tower 2 and you're like, this is sweating. Like, this is getting wet.
It's like sticking all
yeah,
over.
Yeah, like, it's just sticking through my stomach. And I'm like, no, stop. This is not what you wear when you do things like this. So, but I did, I felt pretty, after the first tower, I was like, oh, man, this is easy. Because we had done some Tribune. Like,
yeah, you were a part of the practice
tower.
Team.
Yeah. But by the second and third, I'm like, what am I doing with my life? Like, I really had an existential like fight around the third tower.
I did feel that this year, maybe because it was the first time that we did it last year, I just was kind of in a daze. But like this year, I felt like if I wanted to make an escape, I knew how to make an escape.
Right.
I felt like the escape route this year.
You're absolutely right.
You could have probably done just one.
Because we were talking before this one we were talking about last year, where it felt like they almost peer pressured you to go to the next tower.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't even know where the exit doors were, so you just had to do it. This year, maybe they had a lawsuit or something, but they did something where they made it more, if you want to go left, it's the way out. If you want to keep going.
Right.
So they gave the choice to us, which was terrible. That's where I think that's where the existential crisis came in, where I was just like, there's the door, go for it. Go. Like last year, I was like, they forced you to the next tower.
Yeah.
So you're like, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
Now you're making me decide? Not cool. So anyway, it was great. It was a fun time.
So good.
Yeah. I feel like I've done it 2 years in a row now. So I will say that from here on out, I'm just going to give my money to you, Pete, and you can competitively.
Oh, all right.
You can competitively compete for competition.
Done.
All right.
In your name.
630 is mad at me. Your ignorance precedes you. That's always a good start when you're texting into a radio station. Children got the day off of school on Friday for Pulaski Day. Well, I don't know. Maybe your ignorance precedes you, since the Chicago public school system did not. So I'm sure there are some school districts that may have done that on Friday, but that wasn't the case in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So we can on guard. We can both hit each other with ignorance on that one. So coming up here after the break, let's talk about We Day. Last week, We Day hit the Allstate Arena for the We Movement. What is it? Well, we'll find out here on The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 9:30, John Darnielle is going to join us from The Mountain Goats. We're going to talk about his new novel, Universal Harvester, which is getting great reviews. John, of course, the front man for The Mountain Goats. We'll talk with him about his career in music, but also his novel, which is set in rural Iowa. Well, last week we had a good day. I believe it was Wednesday. Wednesday at the Allstate Arena was We Day, Illinois. It was put on by the We Movement. Really a stellar performance with so many, many kids involved to really celebrate youth culture and volunteerism. It was really a great event, and we had a chance to go out there and we put together this piece. Take a listen. Hundreds of kids mull about in the concourse at the Allstate Arena. They're getting lunch, they're checking out merchandise, or just playing around with friends. But inside the arena, thousands of kids, 16,000 to be exact, scream and yell at the stage during We Day, Illinois. I got a feeling that tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good, good night. A feeling. We Day, Illinois is a celebration of youth and youth culture. Guests include motivational speakers, musicians, actors, and comedians. The audience is comprised of teenagers who participated in We Movement, volunteering in their communities and trying to affect change. The We Movement was created by Craig Kielberger.
21 years ago, when I was a kid, 12 years old, I got excited to start a children's charity, and we couldn't find other groups to mentor us as youth. So often we help kids, but we want kids to do the helping themselves. So we as a movement, as an organization, started to grow. We Schools is giving free service learning to kids. We Day is celebrating and honoring them. And together, it helps to shape young people to be life change agents.
Craig and the We Movement team up with local schools and community groups to get kids to volunteer at homeless shelters, to recycle, to help with hunger, things like that. And if you do it for a certain amount of hours, you get a ticket to the Allstate Arena for the show. But there's no show. There's no We Day Illinois without Allstate. Tom Wilson is the chairman and CEO.
I met Craig out at a conference about 5 years ago, and I just got sold by the concept and the passion. I mean, youth are changing the world, and we just need to get out of the way and help them.
Tom and Craig seem to be inseparable at the event because they're both passionate about changing the narrative when it comes to kids and the stereotypes surrounding their generation.
You know, when you look at the youth here today, 76% of the youth involved in the WE movement here in Illinois are from low-income backgrounds. Half the schools that run our programs are CPS. And I think we need to change our view of young people. This is why we're grateful. Allstate support makes this free to young people who sometimes are written off. And without that support, without that encouragement, without that mentorship, without that belief, but most importantly, without someone saying to them, you are powerful, you can be a change agent, because they know best what the needs are in their community. They know what the ways that they can get involved. So I think as our society, we need to think of service not only being that for the privileged and the few, but to think, how do we empower every person, every young person especially, to see needs in their communities and to have the tools to tackle those needs?
I think it's also about changing our perceptions of ourselves as adults. So, you know, what's our role as it relates to youth? A lot of the times we're like, well, we need to help that kid do something. Actually, what we need to do is inspire the child, tell them we believe in them, and oftentimes just give them the resources and get out of the way. So we have 150,000 children in Illinois today doing volunteer work. If each one of them helps 10 people, that's 1.5 million people. I'm like, I couldn't help 1.5 million people. So if I can help these children do it, like, so my role, I have to define myself differently. And I'm a mentor and a supporter as opposed to a doer.
Daisy Garcia is a senior at DeVry Advantage Academy in Logan Square. Before WE Day, she wasn't very involved in her community. But then it came to her school, and now?
We do a lot through my school. And before, I didn't go to a school that was so involved. And now with this school, it changed everything that what I saw. And it got me involved in WE Day, and I was like, whoa, what is, like, this is awesome. With school, we've done a lot of, we did senior home visits. We did awareness building. We've done the youth summit. We done Hunger Games on our own in our own school. We do a lot of donation drives at our school. I think it's changed me to be more passionate about things and to go out there and find out what's really going on. I know that a lot of people get more involved when they're a lot younger, and something that I wish I would have done when I was younger. Like, now that I'm a senior, I'm like, whoa, I could have started this a long time ago. And this is something that has changed, like, get my own siblings and cousins to, like, get involved, find out what's going on.
And the same goes for Griffin Saul. He's about to graduate from Lincoln Park High School, and he wanted to get involved from an early age because it was a way to honor his dad.
So going into my freshman year of high school, I was seeking opportunities to get more involved than I was already doing. My uncle mentioned the name Craig Kielberger to me, so I researched him, and I was so moved by the fact that somebody so young could make a change, and I identified with that. So I decided to reach out to Craig. And to my surprise, I got an email back. And in his email, he basically validated the fact that I could make a change. He told me something very simple. Issue plus gift equals better world. So I was able to channel my issue of people with disabilities, because my father was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis even before I was born, and my gift for helping others, and combine that into starting We Are Able, an organization to empower youth with disabilities and their families to improve the quality of their lives. It does get overwhelming at times, but I have something to keep me going. It's the legacy of my father, and to let this organization die would be to let his legacy die, and that's something that is dear to my heart, and I can't do that.
WE Day Illinois is just one of the shows put on around the world. London, Seattle, California, and Canada shows already happened, and the next one will be in New York City in April. In Chicago, kids got performances from hip-hop artists Xzibit and Rhymefest, Chicago PD's LaRoyce Hawkins, and Jordan Smith, the past winner of The Voice. Smith loves the ability to connect with the kids.
You know, I think it's such a special cause, and it's amazing to see so many passionate kids in one place that are working together to make the world a better place. But honestly, it's a little bit selfish too, because I always take away so much from it. I'm so inspired by the kids, and selfishly, I really enjoy coming here and feeling their energy and hearing their stories and being inspired myself.
For Allstate and the WE movement, this, it's just the beginning.
I think we have a corporate responsibility. I think all businesses do, and I think we need to step up and do even more. I think, you know, America is a great country. We got lots of freedoms. We got lots of opportunity, but we got this pile of problems in its building, and the government and the nonprofits are working really hard on it. But the pile's getting bigger, so we got to help them. And businesses have the resources, the skills, the people. And when you integrate it into your business, it gives back tenfold. And so we believe businesses need to step up and do more, because it's part of why we exist.
You can find out more about WE Day and the WE movement at WE.org. From the Allstate Arena for WGN Radio, I'm Justin Coffin. Great program. Great events. It's amazing. Think about 16,000 screaming kids. Pete and I walked right into that, and we're like, wow, it's Wednesday morning. Great, great, great event and great organization with the We Movement and We Day Illinois. Coming up, John Darnielle will be here. We'll talk with him about his new novel as well as his work with the Mountain Goats. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a novelist and a singer-songwriter who's coming to Lincoln Hall this week. Of course, I'm talking about one of the most distinct voices in indie rock, the frontman for the Mountain Goats, John Darnielle. Darnielle is an accomplished musician with a great career with the Mountain Goats, who just announced a new album coming out in May. But he's also put together quite a literary resume with his writing. His debut novel, Wolf in White Van, was a National Book Award nominee. His latest novel is called Universal Harvester. It's set in rural Iowa, where a video store clerk stumbles upon a mystery where someone's splicing home movies onto VHS tapes. It's set back in the year 2000. The novel is as much a thriller mystery as an exploration of home, family, and loss. John, thanks for taking some time out. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, man. It's good to be here.
I'm interested because at first, you know, going through your bio, I know that you're a California guy, but you've spent some time in rural Iowa. Where does this story come from? Is this a personal story that deals with the setting?
To some extent. I was in Iowa for a good while. I moved to Chicago for 6 months in 1995. And when I got back from a European tour in November, December, I moved in with my girlfriend, who's now my wife, and she was in Iowa. And I was there from 96 all the way to the end of 2003. And we lived first in Grinnell, where she was going to school, and then we lived in Colo, which is a very, very small town in northeast Story County. And when the city bought our house in order to knock it down, we moved to Ames, and and it was still there. And Colo is a very tiny town. It's not fully rural. It's like the streets have names instead of numbers, but it's next to all the rural stuff. There was a grain elevator at the end of the street. And I lived there for a while, and you can hear from me, I'm kind of a super gabby dude. You know, I'm like, I will sound Californian to most people until I die, but I was pretty interested in the pace and there's slightly mildly different values in not massively. It's not like the way when they do the caucuses every 4 years, they send all the news crews to Iowa and they talk about the people like they were all from the moon or something. So it's not like that, but it is a different pace and a different style. And it's not totally different values, but there's a sort of different ordering of values.
Did you have to just sort of recall that from memory from living in the space? How much research did you have to do to get the story right? Because it is one of these stories that really depends on being in a place, and that place in this case is Iowa.
Well, I have a pretty a sense of place is a big thing with me. I start to soak stuff up as soon as I land someplace. It's like just the geography of a place and the topography of a place. But also, my wife grew up there, so she and her family and her extended family, you know, I've spent a fair bit of the last 20-some years in the company of Iowans, and noticing how, you know, they're more soft-spoken. They're more likely, like if somebody says something way out of left field, you or I might go, what are you talking about, right? Mm-hmm. But in Iowa, they say, oh. they sort of nod. And they might raise their eyebrows a little bit. It's kind of mellow in a weird way. And so I drew a bit from memory, and then and I would look stuff up to make sure I had it right. You know, and to compare my memory versus realities of things.
It's interesting because you've done a lot of autobiographical stuff in your music, but also in the other novels, you've called upon your past. Talk about this story and where you fit in. Do you fit in with the character Jeremy, who's working behind the counter, who lives with his dad and is thinking about changing jobs? I mean, what's the character that you sort of resonate with as the writer?
Well, I mean, I think Lisa Sample is sort of where I'm at more than anybody else. Even though Lisa Sample is. She's a little messed up, and I hope I'm not. But one big thing about her is she's moved around a lot before she's 3 years old. She's been from Tama to Western Iowa and back, and all around, right? And then when she's five, stuff happens that causes her to have to move around a lot more. I don't think that's necessarily traumatic or anything for a kid, but I do remember that when I first became conscious of where I was born. I was in California, but I knew that I was from Indiana. And then we started moving around a lot when I was five. And between five and eight, I think we moved 3 or 4 times. And it's not the worst thing that could happen to a kid, but it leaves a little effect on you to keep leaving stuff behind.
Yeah.
And so I think I relate hardest to that.
That's a great point. I mean, there is a part in this book about leaving things behind or trying to piece things together or just trying to deal with loss and family. That's intentional, of course. How much of that mirrors your life and coming up in the family you came up in?
That really doesn't come from me. It comes more from observing. It's a sort of a mirror thing. Where I grew up, I come from the land of no-fault divorce. California, led the nation in saying, if you need to get a divorce, go on and get it, which was radical at the time and has its values. But so many of my friends came from the sort of either one-parent households or remarried households and stuff like that. When I moved to the Midwest, I found that there was a lot more people whose parents were still together, right? And that wasn't that unusual to go home to the same house you were a kid in at Christmas from college or whatever. And to me, that was kind of novel. Most everybody I know had moved around a fair bit or came from a house with divorce in it. So I was sort of it comes from looking in at the outside and seeing, you know, people holding values that are perhaps less in play or, like I say, are lower on the hierarchy out where I grew up.
You know, it's interesting. The story is one that starts off and continues throughout the book to be a thriller, a mystery to find out what's happening, who's splicing in these home videos into the movies that are at the rental store. You know, for you, how was it as a writer developing a different style, trying to do more thriller, mystery, maybe even a little bit of the remnants around the edges of horror?
Yes. Well, for me, so that was really the most fun part was because I like to blur edges of genre. You know, to me, I think in the movies often they really make sure you fit into one category. But part of the fun of fiction is you can do a bunch of different looks inside of one book and still have a really nice together story. I think, you know, readers, if you're looking to just read a romance, maybe it all sticks in the same thing. But many good books, like Dickens and all the best writers, can be comedy for 10 or 15 pages, but then get very serious and go this way and that way. So for me, that was fun. The fun of it was to have a story that was just about people and about their lives and about maybe a hole that's in the middle of their lives, and then just have that sort of open up very briefly under a window as something disturbing and scary and a mystery, and then draw back. It's sort of like a camera moving from room to room in a house where the rooms are quite different.
For you as a storyteller, not just through what you do with fiction, but also through your music, I mean, are you always evolving in how you want to tell those stories? I mean, are you trying to come up with different genres or different ways to express yourself?
I'm always wanting to challenge myself. That was part of what I wanted to do in this book, was the last book. And then the novella I wrote before it, we're both in the first person, right? If you tell a story in the first person, especially for those of us in the 21st century, that's sort of a second nature, just be talking about ourselves. And so if you take on a character, you just talk through him, and it's kind of, you know, I won't say it's easy, but it's sort of, it makes a few decisions for you. It's, I think, harder to write in the third person. It's a little harder to assume that authorial voice without, you know, and not sound like you're big-headed or not sound like you're, you know, it's hard to get the right tone. So I wanted to challenge myself to do that, to write in the third person, because I was reading a lot of Willa Cather, and she has no difficulty at all writing in the third person in the most plain, wonderful, readable way. And that's what I wanted, was a book that would read real easy and be in the third person, but also have that spy novel zip.
You know, for you as a performer and someone who's had such success both in both realms, both in music and in writing, but how does the performer in you help you as a writer? I mean, I read somewhere that you like to read aloud the work before, because that's how you edit. Talk about how, as a performer, it helps you as a writer.
Well, that's what I do. I mean, it's as a performer and as a musician that I'll write and write. And you write so much, and then at some point you say, well, that seems good, And then I'll usually print it out and stand up and start pacing with the manuscript in hand and reading it out loud to see how the words flow. Because I have and this is a value of mine, I think something should sound good out loud, right? There's some writers who don't, you know, so for some people, that's not a sort of thing they care about. You're reading on the page, you're not probably going to read out loud. But for me, it ought to be good both ways. It ought to be good on the page and it ought to be good out loud. So I stand up and I read and I see if there's any snags. I see if there's parts that seem to drag or where my attention kind of wanders while I'm reading out loud. And then I sit down and attack it with a pencil and read it some more and go back and forth that way. And there is a performative aspect of it for sure.
Do you find yourself taking any work that might be in workshop mode and taking it in front of audiences and trying things out to see how they respond?
No, I don't. Actually, it's funny. I did that with the first book because nobody knew I was writing a book, right? I was doing a couple things. I'd read them. But the thing is like I'm very hesitant to share stuff while it's in development because it sort of feels like it's a little, you know how when birds hatch, their wings are all wet and you have to really protect them. You know, normally they would be in a nest, but if they're born somewhere else, they're in an incubator or something like that. When you have new work like that, you want to protect it from the eyes and ears of other people until it feels strong enough to share.
You mentioned you came to Chicago in 1995. You spent some time. You also penned a nice piece about the empty bottle being sort of the perfect place to be, not just as a musician, but just as a bar, as a venue.
The first place I ever played in Chicago, the empty bottle, 1994.
So talk about your memories of Chicago. Are they still vivid and are they still romantic in a way?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing is, like, it always feels funky when you're talking to somebody who's from a town and you start to say how much you like the town. But I mean, the love I have for Chicago runs very deep into my gut. Like, I grew up watching, being into the Chicago Cubs. We didn't get cable in Southern California until the late 80s or something. But WGN was one of the superstations that we got. And so I started watching the Cubs all the time in the Mark Grace, Sammy Sosa, Mickey Morandini, Gary Gaetti era. Rhino, all those guys, like that was my team, right? And I had, we suffered for a long time, but now we're on top. and when I lived there, I mean, the thing is like, I was there from August through December, January, right? But I also have been to Chicago in the spring. That's one of the most, people talk about Paris in the spring. You can put Chicago right up next to it. It's one of the most beautiful places when the snow has all melted and you have a nice day after toughing it out. It's the best. I mean, I love Chicago to pieces. And the audiences, if you play music, Chicago audiences, that's top five, man. It's some of the best shows you can have.
You know, you got some new
music. I know, it's like, it feels funny because.
No, you're
like,
right.
You know,
hey, you're not going to get played from us.
Truth,
yeah.
Our shows at the Vic are like among my favorite memories in 20 years of touring. Like, that's I can great. Name specific moments on stage at the Vic that are just treasures to me.
You know, new music coming out for you guys. Goss is coming out in May.
Yeah.
Talk about that. Talk about the idea of I'm interested in you personally, you know, having a project that's a novel, then a record. I mean, how do you separate the two and how do they sort of work together in harmony?
So I write songs. I've been writing for so long that it's kind of second nature to me at this point. I just sort of, you know, on any given day, if I have a little bit of an idea, I'll sit down and peck away at it like I'm whittling a piece of wood or something like that. With books, it's like a longer process. I have an office that I keep and I'll go in there. I don't mix the two. When I'm in my office, I don't have a guitar there. I don't have a piano. There is just me and some books and a desk and my typewriter and or my computer. But so yeah, it was with music. I'm working on it all the time. And especially if I've been working hard on a book and I get to a point where I'm not quite sure what I want to do with it next, I'm looking at the outline. It's good to let a book rest from time to time to give it a couple weeks off, you know, to see so you can come back to it with fresh eyes. But in those 2 to 3 weeks, I like to work. I'm a person who likes to work. I don't believe in writer's block. I want to do a little work every day if I can. And so that's when I'll just sit down at the piano or pick up the guitar and start messing with stuff. And I wrote this record when I started writing it when my older son was 2 and a half or so, or maybe 3. And it was hard to work with the guitar because he would always want to swarm it, you know. But I could sit down at the piano, and it would be fun. But at the same time, the piano doesn't move. Whereas if your son climbs on the guitar, then you can't really play it. So I started writing everything on a digital piano using a Fender Rhodes tone, you know. And I could have moved it over to guitar, but I just really got married to the tone. It's such a lovely sound, and and I thought it'd be kind of, you know, be kind of a kick to say, hey, here's a Mountain Goats record. There's no guitars on it, you know.
Well, we're looking forward to it. It comes out in May. The novel, Universal Harvester, is out now. The front man for the Mountain Goats, John Darnielle, is the author of that novel. John, thanks so much for talking with us. We appreciate you taking some time out.
Huge honor for me to be on WGN. I can't even tell you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
But, so, I'm serious, man. It's like, seriously, my 10-year-old self is like, you're going to do an interview on the phone with WGN. No big. Right? Like,
no big.
I mean, I've been watching and listening for years now, but it's like totally in my heart, this is huge.
Yeah,
it's
man. So that's how we feel being on the air, too, so it works out. So, all right, thanks, y'all. We appreciate it, man.
And the Chicago Cubs will beat every team in the league, and the Tampa Bay Bucks will make it all the way through January, and I will love you again. I will love you like I used to. I will love you again.
Coming up, we're going to turn this studio. I'm very excited about this. We're turning this studio into a punk rock jam. Studio 435 tonight gets loud. The Absolutely Not is in studio, the punk rock trio. They're setting up. Oh, it's so fun, man. So fun. Last time we had punk rock, I'm trying to think of maybe Meat Wave. I guess Meat Wave falls into that category. One of the band members is wearing a Meat Wave t-shirt tonight.
Yeah, I think they were just on tour. They went on a tour with Meat Wave. Oh, yeah.
There you go. Absolutely Not. There's some activity out front, some police activity. Looks like there was an accident or something. Huh. I thought maybe they were just attracting the authorities, their punk rock trio-ness. But no, there was a car accident.
Hope it wasn't KK Han leaving no, the station.
Just don't tell me. I got a show to do. I can't help you. Oh, that's good stuff. Coming up in Studio 435, we are going to rock Michigan Avenue. And it's still nice out. I mean, there's people walking around. It's 50, 55 degrees still. And you could tell, like, there are just people outside. They're going to love it. Get that much-needed...
Yeah.
Shot of just,
You need that after a long day.
I know, right? I'm going to pop one of these Werther's that was left over from the road show. He's got a bag of Werther's. I'm going to pop a couple of those. Yeah. Get the testosterone going, adrenaline pumping. It's going to be a great hour. I'm excited.
Werther's.
Yeah, it's a new brand. It's a soft Werther's, which I think sacrilege.
Very nice.
But it is, but I'm going to eat like 10 of them. While the band's playing, watch me on the webcam.
I'm a little concerned about the weather. In as such as that, you know, there's going to be a, you know, Rob's been reporting that, you know, a storm's going to roll through, and normally, you know, it doesn't bother me. Storms kind of roll through, but now I hear that it's going to be from like 1 to 3 a.m. That's when it's going to roll through the city.
Yeah, right.
And I get home at 1.
So you can hopefully make it in before the.
I want to go to bed.
Yeah, dog's not going to let you, man.
And then the dog is going to be up for 2 hours because it's thunder and lightning. Dog's crawling over you.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's tough. I don't have pets, so I don't have a situation where... And my son doesn't care. He sleeps right through it.
I want the storm to come in about 7, 8, be over by the time I get home. I have to deal with it.
I always just assume that storms either come in the overnight or right at rush hour. There's the only two times there'll be any storm. You never see a storm at like 11 a.m. It just doesn't happen. There's probably some meteorological reason for that. But, you know, the most inopportune time, like today I was coming in. I'm like, this drip started to happen. I'm like, come on.
Yeah, of course.
Of course, right around 5 o'clock. So, yeah. Big hour coming up. We got a big show tomorrow night as well. I'm very excited about it. Madeline Dubeck will be back to talk about Downstate, which is I love that the Downstate politics has been taken over by a rapper.
Mm-hmm.
Way to go. You're at the point where the artist and musician is getting more sympathy for his work than the politicians. It's interesting. Someone, 630, just said, I don't buy it that he's given $1 million. Check that out.
Hmm.
Like, well, all right. Yeah. I don't know if at this point he's really going to go back on his word. Because, you know, it was interesting the way it was set up. Like, they just did, like, the media's done a lot of fuzzy math to make it $1 million because it's $10,000 to a certain amount of schools
right.
that add up to a million. Mm-hmm. And it's really for arts. I wanted to talk about it. When I heard that, I was like, yes. If you listen to the show and you pay attention to us, we talk to all these artists, these young artists who are, you know, even the bands that will be on tonight or even the bands that, you know, that some of the artists we're going to have on this week. They come from Chicago. They were able to, like a Chance the Rapper, be able to collaborate with others from the city that they come together in After School Matters programs mm-hmm. or at Gallery 37 or other places around the idea of arts and music.
Yeah.
And so it's unbelievable that Chance the Rapper is giving back that way. I mean, people want to say it's $1 million. They want to ease Ivan in the carryout kind of said $1 million to CPS. It's not really $1 million to CPS. It's $10,000 to certain schools for their arts program.
Mm-hmm.
They're not applying it to math. You know, one of the jokes I wanted to I just didn't get around to it was Chance the Rapper giving $1 million to CPS, which is going to be very excited to be able to get those out-of-date textbooks shrink-wrapped in the warehouse that we never see again, right? Like, it's not like that, you know. In 5 years, you'll be like, oh, these are the books Chance gave us. Oh, that's great. Nobody ever opened them. It's great. Can we photocopy them? Just hand those out? No, but he's giving the money to arts programs,
yeah.
which is great. That's a tremendous, tremendous thing. And we've had so many artists that have been inspired
right.
by that.
So many.
On this program who have come out of Chicago and are doing things on the national, global level. So it's really exciting to make sure that those programs continue for a next generation of students that come through Chicago. All right, coming up, a little punk rock. I'm very excited. Studio 435. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. It's Monday night, so it's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer. And tonight, we welcome in the studio the punk rock trio Absolutely Not. The band's latest release is called Programmed. It's a single, and they're working on new music that should be out this summer. They're playing on March 18th at Kohl's in Logan Square. The trio consists of Donnie Moore, Madison Moore, and Santiago Guerrero. And here they are with the first track tonight, the single Program. Take it away, guys. My head hurts. That's good. From banging it, that's good. Absolutely not. In studio, the punk rock trio, Donnie Moore, Madison Moore, and Santiago Guerrero. The single that was programmed, that's the latest single they've released. They've got some music coming out this summer. What we'll do is we'll take a quick break here. When we come back, we will talk with the members and hear some more music from Absolutely Not. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Studio 435 every Monday night. Tonight, no different. This is our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has. And tonight, we are listening to the punk rock trio Absolutely Not. The band's latest release called Program came out in the fall. New music that should be out this summer. They're playing on March 18th at Kohl's in Logan Square. Donnie Moore, Madison Moore, and Santiago Guerrero are in studio. Guys, thanks for coming in and playing. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, thanks for
thank you.
This is the, it's funny because you're wearing the Meat Wave t-shirt. This, you're a second punk band. Meat Wave was the first to be on the show. And I feel like Chicago has a tremendous history in punk rock music. I feel like, I think of Naked Ray Gun and other bands that came through here that, you know, I don't know if Chicago always gets the sort of national notoriety for its punk scene, but
sure,
there are so many bands that come. How, as a band that's out now, and you guys have been playing for about a decade, do you think about the sort of historical roots of punk music here in Chicago?
Yeah, I mean, that was part of what drew me here, for sure, because we both grew up in Florida, and Chicago's music scene was definitely like a big draw for me.
What were you drawn to? What, tell us the time period.
I mean, time period wise, I bounce all over the place. Like, I like a lot of different kinds of bands from a lot of different times. But with Chicago, the music scene, I just noticed, was always a little edgier than some of the other places. Like California, they kind of tend to maybe lean towards the things that are a little more, you know, friendly, I guess. And then the East Coast is like New York. It's just impossible to stand out in New York no matter what you do. Right, I could light myself on fire in Times Square and no one would care. So it's like, true, you know, but so it's like here, it's like you at least kind of have a chance, maybe. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the scene is really supportive.
And the scene is very supportive.
Awesome,
yeah.
Awesome.
Let's talk, Santiago, you grew up here.
Yeah.
So talk about, I mean, when you think of those, when I say the name Naked Ray Gun and you're playing drums for a punk band, I mean, what's that mean to you?
Huge influence. They're easily one of the most recognizable
Chicago
punk. Oh, yeah, like, for sure. Hardcore punk bands.
And, yeah.
You know, they played Wrigley Field last year.
Yeah, right.
Did they really?
Actually,
they opened
for
Dave Grohl, yeah.
My friend Fritz plays bass in Naked Ray Gun, so they're definitely a really awesome band. I was always really into this band, Los Crudos, from Chicago. So my life was changed one time when I like went to a house show and I was like 16, so the punk scene for sure, like,
it's
a
I mean it's such
life.
A oh yeah, I think about the punk bands of my generation. I feel like there was a big move towards suburban punk. Elgin had a scene that was the Third Floor, and I think of the bands at the Fireside Bowl that sort of came out. I mean there seems like we'll always know the late 80s to be a punk sort of time for Naked Ray Gun, but in the 90s you had bands that were, I guess they fall in the category of punk, but I think of the Green Day bands of like the Smoking Popes or Alkaline Trio came out of that thing, or I'm
Screeching Weasel.
Screeching Weasel, from, John Pearson, yeah.
Yeah, just outside of Chicago.
So I mean, there are a lot of bands. I mean, when you guys think, when I mention those groups, where do you guys fit in? Where does an Absolutely Not fit in? Do you feel like you're a part of that sort of that movement, or do you feel like you're something different?
I guess yes and no. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel like I try to, with the songs, I think the vibe that we set out is kind of like trying to be somewhere in between everything, where it's, you know, influenced by a lot of different stuff, influenced by like 70s glam rock, influenced by like 90s grungy punk stuff, and, you know, all over the place. I don't want to just have like one defined like sound necessarily, but at the same time, you know, you want to You want to have something that like sounds like absolutely not, but I don't want to just be like, oh, every song is like 1 minute and it's like, you know, this timing.
right.
There's
a formula to punk music in a way that
yeah.
You guys in a way honor. Your songs are short.
Sure. Right.
But listening to your song and even the program that we just heard, I mean, the it's not the same sort of four chord structure that you're just sort of right. beating your instruments till they bleed.
Right.
It's not that kind of thing. So talk about how you guys approach punk music and or punk rock music and how it differs from the sort of traditional that we know.
Oof. I guess I would say the best answer I guess I have is that I just don't think about anything, you know, and I know that sounds like really stupid, but it's true. Like when I'm writing something or thinking about how I want the song to go or mm-hmm. it just comes out. Like I'm not like, oh, I want this part to repeat five times or this part to do that. It just kind of comes out. And then I take that and piece, hopefully a good song out of whatever happens. So that's kind of where I'm at. That's why I'm at, like, I don't necessarily go by a certain punk rock structure, but like you said, at the same time, all of our songs are like punk rock length and they're fast.
Automatically. I mean, you are a trio.
Yeah.
So when I think of punk rock trios, and that is a thing, yeah. I mean, it was guitar, bass,
fast,
drums, go.
Minute and a half.
You yeah. already sort of change it up with the keys and you do something different.
Right.
Talk a little bit about the idea of deconstructing punk rock by using some different instruments.
Well, I can't play bass guitar very well. So that's going to be reason number one.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. There have been times where we've thought about like introducing, because I am kind of learning how to play that now. But it's kind of our thing.
Yeah.
So I don't really want to
mess
with
it. Keys are more interesting, as silly as that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess that's not silly, but it's just like, I just find you can do more with the song
yeah.
if you have like,
being able
you know,
to change the tones,
yeah.
actually.
Being like, able to change the tones and the yeah. voices and things like that, so it's not just like a bass and a guitar
yeah.
and drums. Like,
well, you talk about it. I mean, even in some of your categorizations of the music,
yeah.
you're punk, but you also mentioned glam, sort of the
oh,
late
yeah.
seven.
Oh, and Devo and things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, you feel
oh, yeah.
like the keyboard goes in that direction and adds that element,
for
and
sure.
it automatically changes up the music.
Yeah,
right.
Because I'm just as into inspired by like bands like Devo and like Missing Persons, and because Missing Persons was another great band that made it really far and had like big hit singles, and they didn't have a bass player. They had two keyboardists, a drummer, a guitarist, and a lead singer. And I was always like, huh, like no bass, one guitar, and two keys. It's like, okay.
And there's Screamers, which is all
yeah,
keys.
And Screamers, which is all keys, which is amazing too. Okay. Yeah. Another great band.
We're talking with the band, the punk rock trio, Absolutely Not, here from Chicago. They're playing March 18th at Kohl's and Logan Square. They're going to perform in just a second. We'll play another one. You know, we were talking before, Santiago, just was a sound check, that there really is this sort of two ways that a punk rock band can go. One is a very young band that just, like I said, wants to make their instruments bleed.
Sure.
I mean, everything you possibly do, like take out
fine. Yeah.
take out the rage and that, right. you, like you want to say something and you want to say it through the music and you want to yeah. play fast.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the other that, I mean, there's a skill to it. There's as you get older mm-hmm. and you continue, you'll see a lot of punk rock bands kind of move out of the music and try
sure.
to do other things. But the ones that stay through, there is this sort of discipline and skill that goes into punk rock music. Where do you guys fit in? I mean, when you think about that, I mean, you're sort of in the middle of that. I mean, you guys are skilled musicians, but talk about the idea of sticking with this type, this genre of music for as long as you have.
Well, I think one of the main reasons why the three of us work really well is that we all listen to a lot of the same kind of music. Like, we also go off and listen to very different things too. But as far as like the key place that Absolutely Not is usually headed or like in or whatever, we're all very much into that style, and I think that energizes us too, and I don't, or at least it does with me. I don't know about
yeah.
you guys.
I think we're all really into the concept of mixing what you said, the making instruments bleed, and then the melody, like you said.
Yes.
It starts out more often than not when you're younger. I was in just hardcore and power mm-hmm. violence bands, and you know, the older you get, you're like, oh, well, maybe I can mix in melody. Getting better at your instrument is
100%.
Part of that.
Yeah, right.
So it's like, I think it's just kind of like part of a natural evolution artistically to just kind of incorporate that melody. but not to the point where you're not staying true to the original forms and what you're inspired by, like articles of faith or Naked Raygun.
Yeah, yeah. Like you start in a raw place, but then you take that and turn it into something that, you know, maybe is a little more thought out or, you know, like,
just,
I mean,
to expand a little bit.
Yeah, because, I mean, even the earlier Absolutely Not songs in comparison to some of the later stuff, the earlier stuff is even a little more towards the punk mentality you're talking about, where it's just like very straight up and just bleh.
Well, I don't want to ruin a good conversation by playing live music, but that's what we're going to do right now. Absolutely Not is in studio. What are we going to hear? What track are we going to hear?
This is a brand new single.
All right.
Yes. This
What's
is
it called?
Called Strictly Top.
Strictly Top?
Yes.
Strictly Top. Absolutely Not, the punk rock trio here from Chicago playing Kohl's on March 18th in Logan Square. We got Donnie Moore, Madison Moore, and Santiago Guerrero, the three of them together. Absolutely Not. Here it is. I guess this will be the single, right? You called it
this
out.
This will be possibly one of the
possibly
singles.
One of the singles. All right, take it away, guys. Got that punk rock stop too. I like it. The Absolutely Not in studio 435 tonight. You can hear them at Logan. They'll be at Kohl's in Logan Square on March 18th. Donnie Moore, Madison Moore, Santiago Guerrero in studio. And it's amazing. And I mean, talk about the new music real quick before we go to news. I mean, this is sort of, you guys have been working on this. It's coming out this summer?
Yes. It's coming out at the end of July, fingers crossed. Yeah.
How long does it take to put a record? I mean, if you're already talking about new singles, I mean, you're obviously along the route.
Yeah, this one we actually just finished tracking it 3 days ago, right? I think 3 days ago or four, or whatever it was. And we're mixing it on the 9th and the 10th of this month. So, it'll be done. But, you know, that's just the beginning of, you know, 8,000 stages.
Yeah.
So.
Donnie did finger quotes when he said done.
I did do finger quotes, and I'm on the radio. Everyone saw me do it.
Donnie
Quote,
Moore,
unquote.
Donnie Moore, Madison Moore, Santiago Guerrero, Absolutely Not in studio. They're playing March 18th at Kohl's in Logan Square. When we come back, we'll talk some more about the music, about your guys' process, and also about punk rock in general here on The Download. Thanks, Rob. It's The Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio 435 tonight, Absolutely Not, the punk rock trio. They're playing at Kohl's on March 18th in Logan Square. Donnie Moore, Madison Moore, Santiago Guerrero. The single that's out right now is called Programmed. They got new music that should be out this summer. We're going to hear one more track tonight here in Studio 435 a little bit later in the hour. But first, let's talk some more punk rock. I love it. I love it. You're bringing me back, guys. Okay, so one of the things I read about you guys, which is really interesting, is that, you know, when you started out, you know, you play like places like Ronnie's or other places that may not be around anymore. And you would play for 2, 3, 4 people in the audience. Talk about that. I mean, because
that was a good night.
You know, and but the arc of this story is that, you know, in recent years, you guys are headlining Metro.
Yeah.
You're on tour with Meatwave, which is hot right now. I mean, that's the hot band. So, I mean, I don't say that to say, oh, you guys played at 3 to 4 people, but it talks about the how long it takes, because this was 10 years ago or so.
Like 8 to 10. I'm really bad with timeline stuff. But, yeah, it was about 8 to 10 years ago. And definitely played a bunch of shows at, like, Ronnie's. Even the first time I played Empty Bottle, I believe there was maybe like 30 or 40 people there. And that room is a lot bigger, so when there's that many people in there and you're playing, you're like, oh, God. You know, like, it's just like, it's very uncomfortable.
How do you get from Ronnie's and 4 people to headlining Metro? How does that happen? I mean, I talk about the process as a local band, an independent band that is trying to, a punk rock trio, that is trying to make your name in this city. How do you go from 3 people to 500 at a show?
Well, honestly, for me personally, I just kept going no matter what happened. That was number one. Like, no matter how many bad shows I had, I just kept playing because I just was like, I don't care. I'm going to keep writing these songs whether people like it or not. So maybe I'll just always play to 10 people. Maybe I won't. And I also just made sure that I definitely never tried to placate to any certain, I just try to stay true to what I was doing without breaking from that.
Is that hard, you guys? I mean, as a band who will play and there might be a couple months straight where there's 6, 7 people, you're like,
oh, yeah,
maybe we should be doing what, I don't know, No Doubt's doing.
Right.
Or I don't know what the band of the record is.
It's soul crushing.
One of those things you can't help, actually. I feel like at the end of the day, like, you're gonna, you, even if you know you could maybe be more successful doing something different, there's something in you that needs that. I feel like it's 33% tenacity, 33% masochism.
Yeah.
And 33% for sure. Just loving, like, what kind
passion,
of music,
right?
And
right.
Being, you know, like, just passion. Yeah, exactly. Like, when we go on tour, we just listen to angular post-punk and goth and the 70s punk. And
Madison, like, was there ever
dark metal?
Was there ever a time where you're like, all right, this is not worth it? Is this not, you know, when you're in the first couple years and you're like, what are we doing here?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, it, of course, you get frustrated when you play like a bunch of, you know, just crappier shows in a row. It's like, okay, well, that sucks. But you just, you keep going. Networking is really important, talking to people. And the scene, like I said before, is super supportive, so it's easy to do. Booking shows with other bands, that's what I mean by networking. Like, you all kind of have each other's
just
back.
Building connections.
Bring people out, talking, talk about
Santiago, stuff. You mentioned this earlier when you're talking about being a kid and getting into punk rock music. You mentioned the idea of house shows.
Yeah, that's what I grew up on.
Yeah, and you know, we had the guys from Twin Peaks were in here, they talked about that's how they kind of got their following. They would do these house shows in Rogers Park or Logan Square and other places. Talk about that culture. I mean, because you know, people listening right now may go, okay, you're just going from club to club to bar to bar.
No.
But there's a whole other
way
to get an audience, and that has to do with essentially playing in your
living room. Honestly one of the biggest things and one of the hardest, shockingly, sometimes in Chicago to get is like a good house show. Like, sure, you could play house shows or whatever, but to get on that show, because, you know, it caters to people that maybe can't go to the 21 and up clubs that are, you know, 20 or 19 and really want to go to a cool show, but they can't go to anything. And it's also provides a different energy because you're not in a bar atmosphere, you know, where like you paid to get in and, you know, it's someone else's, like, you know, it's,
I also think part of the draw is just, the rawness of,
that's
the,
what I'm saying.
Being
yeah.
able to experience, like, you hear a band over their great sound system, it's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you can see a band stripped of all the monitors and all the extra stuff and just kind of
And you're on the same level as them, like on the ground floor with them.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it,
they can break your stuff.
Yeah, there's no break room. You just
kind of, I mean, but there's no doubt that, I mean, you think back to just to history as a fan of music, I've seen probably as many bands in basements as I have in clubs.
Mm-hmm. What, sure.
But there is, I mean, there's a movement, and it seems like in the last, I don't to date myself, but like the last decade or so, where it's become much more of a thing. There are like you just said, there are certain houses that you want to play, almost like certain clubs.
It is. It's the same dynamic. I mean, it's different, but it's the same.
Well, there's Albion House in Rogers Park, which has been going since the early '90s. Which I might be wrong, but I heard was maybe started by the guys from Alkaline Trio or something from that scene. So that's like a really long.
So there are certain houses in Chicago that have sort of a musical tradition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then unfortunately, a lot of them also get shut down.
Well, that's the second part of this, as we talk on WGN Radio, they're illegal.
I mean, they're for sure illegal. Yeah,
they're essentially like a house party, or the parents are away,
and that's half the fun. I think that also where some of the energy comes from too is like you're all in there like, it's just like. So it's like, I think that it's true, though. I think that's where it comes
from. It's kind of part of the game, though. It's like people get so, make kind of huge deals sometimes when like a house of like 2 years gets shut down. It's like, that's just how it works. There's a natural regeneration.
Yeah, and there will be five new ones pop up.
Cool.
Yeah,
right.
Because there's always a new house. You go, what's Margaritaville? What?
Right.
Margaritaville.
Yeah, that's a house.
Oh, some of the names are so good.
Some of the names are hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
Like there's names, code names for the houses. That's great.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So and they're pretty, some of them are really great.
I chose my basement in Little Village, or my backyard in Little Village in like around 2007. And I actually can't say the name on the radio, but it was a whole lot of fun. Right? Like we had a really good time.
It's interesting because we have these bands on and we talk to them about their success, and almost all of them are rooted in this underground sort of community that Chicago has for rock bands, for punk rock bands that we never hear about, that they're just not talking. And this is when I hear you say they have code names for the houses.
Oh, yeah.
You start to get a better understanding of how the city sort of not only is diverse and has a bunch of different places, but nurtures itself in the way that there's so many house parties. You can actually, there's a hierarchy to the house party.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You can't make a Facebook event for it without text me for the address written on the inside.
Well, it's kind of like Donnie was saying, the house shows are sort of a manifestation of something that just kind of needs to happen, which is there needs to be a space to see a band that's not a club or something, and there's a community to it. There's a lot more of a community to that. So I think sometimes there needs to be a place.
Does
for
it
kids.
Become harder for you guys? I mean, obviously, as you have more success and you're on tour with Meatwave or you play at Metro, does it become harder to sort of you move on from that sort of scene and move into a different one?
I definitely don't want to.
We love basement shows.
I just want to be available to do anything, I guess. I know that's probably not possible all the time, but I don't ever want to be that band that's like too cool to play the house or vice versa, even where it's just like I just want to be able to do whatever. I like all the crowds at all the places. I like the feelings that I get from both places. So
well, let's talk about those feelings. Absolutely not the punk rock trio in studio 435 tonight. We're still going to get another track for them. They're playing March 18th at Kohl's in Logan Square. Let's talk about why you guys do it. I mean, is the idea of fame and fortune the concept that you are living life in Malibu and no that's not it?
No. It's the music industry.
I'm just
sniffing it out, guys.
Yeah. No. What is it? I mean, what feel are you going for?
I mean, ideally, sure, we would all like to be like career musicians like we are right now for the like kind of, I mean, we would like it to be
the
like,
only source of income.
The only source of income need. Or the for sure like hardcore main source of income. So I guess that would be great, but
how do you do that? I guess
I'm still figuring that out.
You're right. I mean, it's
not sure.
I mean, even the paths that were once laid out for the music industry have been dismantled.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not sort of like, I guess I'm just going to keep playing high profile shows till somebody comes along and gives me money. That's gone.
Right.
So, I mean, for you as an independent band in a genre that is almost anti-establishment being in punk rock.
Sure.
I mean, what are the ways that you see yourselves getting to the goal of being professional musicians or musicians that are self-sustaining?
Mm-hmm. Well, we try to tour as much as humanly possible and just play, because we don't want to just play like 100 shows a year in Chicago, because that's just annoying when bands do that. And so we want to like travel around and, you know, like spread, because it's like you could nail your city and that's great. And if that's all you want to do, there's nothing wrong with that. There are plenty of bands that just want to local. Right. And that's awesome. Like I have no, I'm not saying anything negative about that, but we're definitely a band that wants to go as far as possible. Like we would like to go to Europe eventually. We love going to the West Coast. We love going to the East Coast. And I feel like the best way to get the most listeners is to expose as many people as you possibly can to your music. And since, you know, it's harder to do that through PR and other things sometimes, you got to just kind of do it yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're talking with Absolutely Not in studio. Okay, so we're going to take a break. We will come back. We'll get one last track from you guys in studio. They're playing, Absolutely Not's playing at Kohl's in Logan Square on March 18th. Donnie Moore, Madison Moore, Santiago Guerrero in studio. We'll take a break. We'll come back. More music. Stay with us. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Patty Vasquez takes over. But up to that point, it is still Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer tonight. The punk rock trio, Absolutely Not. The band's latest release is called Programmed. They're working on new music that should be out this summer. They're playing on March 18th at Kohl's in Logan Square. Donnie Moore, Madison Moore, and Santiago Guerrero are the trio. And here is the B-side from the single from Program. This is Vacation, live in Studio 435. Take it away, guys.
Mama's in the mirror, crying up her makeup, because daddy wants some scarlet as well. Sister's at the mall, just dreading to look sexy, and grandma smells like coconut. I'm all just crying up for makeup. The grandma took away all the blue.
Yeah. Yeah, there's the screaming we were promised. Absolutely Not in Studio 435 tonight. The punk rock trio of Donnie Moore, Madison Moore, Santiago Guerrero. They're playing at Kohl's March 18th. That was the B-side of the single Program. That was Vacation, complete with screaming. That was good screaming. That was strong.
Well, thank you.
That was strong. So, all right, what's next for you guys? I mean, we talked about new music. I mean, what's the process? I mean, do you guys put that out as an album?
Yeah. Wait, what is that? I mean, that, sometimes when we do those songs, I get a little going
well,
the cuckoo.
Normally,
land.
We kind of do like a lot of bands, since for time and money reasons, we do kind of just like try to do like five or six songs in a day, maybe a whole album. And we did a totally different process this time. We recorded just two songs at a time, which totally allowed us to like really focus. And we just finished tracking it, so we shot the album cover today.
Sorry, I rejoined the universe.
Okay, so an album. This is good for you guys, because you guys have done EPs and you've done singles. I mean, talk about the idea of actually constructing out a full album.
With this one, it's called Errors. And every song is kind of about someone that's, you know, has some sort of weird flaw or
quirk
or concern, or, You know, and it's also like the middle song that we played is kind of like an anthem for anyone who's kind of misunderstood at this present time, mm-hmm. and as far as like minorities and things like that go. So this whole album is kind of a concept about that. It's about just like the odd people that are either considered errors because they're actually horrible or considered errors because they're just different from everybody
else. They don't fit in. Well, there's something to that. I mean, the idea that you guys as a punk trio, you don't sort of follow the mold of, I think, as you put it, four straight, you know, straight white dudes who just jam on their instruments until there's no tomorrow. I mean, you guys have a different thing, a different makeup and a different thing going on.
Yeah. No, for sure. It just kind of spawns from, I think, a lot of my own emotion to it. I mean, you even just heard her and the screaming at the end. Like, obviously, that's like a real like scream. That's not. I guess not it, that's I. You know, we just try to be genuine. I'm very, very much about genuine music. I can immediately tell if it's false. Like, you watch some of the bands with their stage antics or the lyrics that they have, and you're just like, God, how many hours you sit on the edge of your bed rewriting that sentence? Like, it's so...
Watching yourself in the mirror.
Yeah, watching yourself play the guitar part in the mirror, being like, this is so good.
But you guys are like,
my hair right now.
Right.
Well, I mean, there is something to the idea of putting the music together, writing the music from a different perspective, from a different point of view. I mean, punk rock has been very rudimentary in a good way, but it has been, as you talked about, sort of the power violence to sort of like, this is us and this is how I feel.
Yes.
You know, I mean, this is it. So, I mean, for you to bring a different element to that music, that's refreshing in this day and age in 2017.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate that. And it's like, I like to do that half of the time, and the other half of the time, lyrically especially, the songs are usually kind of like me creating a fake character of someone that I would never be or would never maybe even want to be, and kind of writing a song about that person through their perspective, which sounds odd, but it's true. It's just, I don't like just writing. People always say like, write what you know, or, you know, keep it. Like, I don't like doing that. I like going to weird places. And
well, we just had this conversation, it was the Hanson family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were in, and we talked about they do murder ballads.
Yeah.
And so they will construct, you know, an old murder ballad. I mean, they're doing fiction.
Yeah.
They come to the same sort of, you know, back and forth about they never killed anybody.
Right. you have to go into that mind.
Right.
And
so it is fiction writing. I mean, there's something about storytelling as a musician.
Yeah. That's exactly what it is. It's like a lot of the songs are me just telling a story that has absolutely nothing to do with anything that I would ever do in my life ever. But that's half the fun of singing about it.
All right. So let me ask you this as we wrap up tonight. This is a new segment for Studio 435. To see a punk rock band that's not you.
Yeah.
Who should we see and where should we see them? In Chicago.
Okay, we have, this list could go on
forever.
Like 4 hours. but I mean, obviously we've been talking a lot about Meat Wave, so definitely say Meat Wave.
Love them.
The bands that we're playing with at Kohl's on the 18th.
No
Men and Wad are two of the best bands in Chicago right now, and I'm sure...
The idea being, let's go see Meat Wave. Where would be the best place to see Meat Wave? If that punk rock band, where's the best place to see punk rock in Chicago? Empty Bottle?
Empty Bottles.
Which is a place
the best shows. I mean, they're pretty good. They bring the same energy no matter where they are, which is part of why we enjoy them so much and enjoy like teaming up with them for stuff, especially because they definitely come from that same place, I can tell. Or it's like it's all genuine. It's no...
Well, if we can't get into Margaritaville, the house, then we will go to Empty
Margaritaville,
Bottle.
Margaritaville.
What was it called?
It's a cool place. Actually, a really cool band I like called Chew, who a lot of members are actually also originally from Orlando.
Yeah.
Chew
is a great band, yes.
They play there. So.
Okay. Well, if we can't get in there, because I have a feeling me knocking on the door is not going to work, then we'll go to Empty Bottle to see our punk rock.
Yeah, yeah.
So
we'll
it's great. Thank
we'll
you. Thank you. It's a dream come true. I'm with the band. I'm with these guys. I'm with absolutely not the punk rock trio who are playing on March 18th at Kohl's in Logan Square. Donnie Moore, Madison Moore, and Santiago Guerrero in studio. The latest release, a single called Program. The B-side was Vacation, which we just heard. And they're working on new music that should be out this summer.
Yes.
Guys, thanks so much for being here. Appreciate
it. Thank you very much for having us.
And thank you for listening. A fun night tonight.